My guest is comic book artist and screenwriter Daniel Clowes. His comic book series, Ghost World, was adapted into a 2001 film of the same name, which starred Scarlett Johansson and Thora Birch as best friends just out of high school, trying to figure out what to do next. Clowes co-wrote the screenplay with Terry Zwigoff, who also directed the film. They've collaborated on a new movie scheduled to open in the fall called Art School Confidential, based on Clowes' memories of art school. His comic book series, 8-Ball, was described in Salon.com as mercilessly taking on middle-class conformity, artistic pretension, teen angst, cartoonists, hipsters, the horrors of adulthood, proselytizing Christians, sports fans, sexual banality, and, perhaps most consistently, Clowes himself. The graphic novelist Chris Ware called Clowes easily the best cartoonist in America and said, somehow he's able to blend satire and sympathy, two sensibilities which are generally mutually exclusive. Daniel Clowes has a new book, a comic strip novel called Ice Haven. Daniel Clowes, welcome back to Fresh Air. Where do you imagine Ice Haven as being? And describe the town to us.
Ice Haven is a fictional Midwestern town. I think of it as existing somewhere in that region of states around Illinois, somewhere in either Wisconsin, Michigan, or possibly Minnesota. It's the kind of place that has little resort towns that nobody quite ever goes to, or that might have been popular at one point, but are no longer big attractions. And I thought of Ice Haven as this kind of sad resort town that possibly they moved the freeway or something and nobody ever goes there anymore. And that's where it came from.
Now, one of the children in the city, David Goldberg, goes missing. And a couple of the kids who were reading a comic book about the Leopold and Loeb murder, in which two young men commit a murder to prove their superior intelligence because they think that they can commit the murder and never be caught. So these kids figure that there's some kind of Leopold and Loeb thing going on. Did you read a Leopold and Loeb comic like these kids did?
No, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, very, very near the actual scene of the Leopold and Loeb murders. And it was an event that sort of haunted my childhood. It was something, it changed its meaning over the years. The first time I heard the story, I really related to the poor kid Bobby Franks, who was killed by these two guys. And then there's something about the story where at a certain point, once they've committed this murder and then they sort of realize that they've blown it and they're going to be caught, there's this period where they're kind of waiting for the net to close around them. There's something so emotional and so specifically horrible about that I found it resonated with me for years and years. And it's sort of this primal story in my life that I think about a lot.
Now, there's actually a character in your comic who points out that you have that connection to the story, and he's a very pretentious comic book critic named Harry Neighbors. Are there actually comic book critics?
Well, there are, yes, and every one of them thinks that they are Harry Neighbors. I you know, do interviews and things with people who are comic book critics, and they are all convinced that I'm making fun of them, and I wanted to have this guy who is a comic book critic, but you see that he lives in this really fancy, huge apartment, and he's very wealthy from being a comic book critic, which I think is quite unlikely. And then at another point, I realized that I had created this critic who is obsessed with me. It's like there are no critics out there who are actually you know, devoted to me. So I thought I had to create my own. And in some ways, he's very much a figure of comfort in my life. It's like I feel like, well, nobody else reads it, but at least Harry Neighbors enjoys my work.
So Harry Neighbors, the comic book critic, thinks that the expression graphic novel is a vulgar marketing sobriquet. But you actually have a very perfect description. I mean, on the cover of your book, Ice Haven, it says a comic strip novel. And I thought, yeah, that's what we should all use. Because graphic novel, if I tell somebody I'm interviewing or I'm reading them a graphic novel, unless they know what I'm talking about, they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, they think you're talking about Henry Miller or something.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, I thought of comic strip novel as a very specific term to this book because I originally got the idea from, I bought a collection of old Sunday newspaper strips from 1950 through 1965. And I was reading through them and I was just struck by there's something so wonderful about this mixture of styles and intents and sort of tonal shifts, you know, where you have Mary Worth and that's very serious, and then it's followed by Henry, where it's sort of a light little kid strip, and then that's followed by Dick Tracy, and then you have Prince Valiant, and you have all these different things all mixed together on the same page, and yet there's some kind of cohesive unity about the whole thing. There's a, you know, they're using the same color palettes and they're using the same, you know, implements to draw the strips, and there's a certain cohesion to it, this kind of internal cohesion. And one day I was reading one and I thought, you know, there's a strip where I think Henry loses a glove in his comic, and I thought, how cool would it be if that glove turned up in Prince Valiant like 4 pages later? And so, and from there, that's where the idea of Ice Haven came. And so it really very much is a comic strip novel. It's really I don't know if it qualifies as a novel at 88 pages, but it's a larger narrative made up of comic strips.
I want to talk to you just about the drawing style in Ice Haven, and let's start with the cover. I look at the cover, and it has this effect on me. I feel like I'm being transported back to, I think, my childhood. I think I grew up with so many images that come from a kind of similar place in terms of the colors, the forms, even the lettering. I mean, the lettering for the title Ice Haven, it's that kind of 3D lettering with like black shadows, but each letter is a different color. And the colors are, you know, like a blue and an amber and a red and a yellow, but they're all slightly faded. And I see that, and I think the 1950s.
I'm trying to draw in a style that just seems sort of comfortable and pleasing, that on the surface you just think like, oh, look at these friendly cartoon characters. I want it to really seem like a Sunday newspaper kind of a feel, you know. And I'm using colors that are slightly muted. I mix a certain mixture of sort of a brownish yellow into all the colors so that it looks somewhat like it's on faded newsprint. I want it to feel sort of lived in. You know, there's no actual white in the whole book. It's all sort of off-white, like it's been sitting around for a little while. I always say that I want my ideal place for my books is I'm not so interested in seeing them in the bookstore brand new, but I like the idea of seeing the spine in a used bookstore and the thought of some, you know, 17-year-old version of me in 20 years finding that and just, you know, saying, what in the world is this, Ice Haven, and pulling it out, because that's how I found so many of the books that I was influenced by as a teenager or as a young artist. And that's, I wanted it to look like something that already fit on a used bookstore shelf.
I have this theory, which I suppose isn't my theory, but just something everybody already knows, which is that the first images that you see, the first music that you hear when you're young, just becomes wired into your brain, and you can't help yourself
against
responding to that.
You just
absolutely respond to that. Can you describe some of the images that you grew up with that you think are wired in you?
Well, I luckily had an older brother who was kind of a media junkie in the kind of the pre-television days, and so he had stacks of old comic books, especially, which that was my only sort of source of entertainment as a kid. We didn't have a TV until I was much older, and so I would just sit in my room and read through these comic books that I actually could not even read. I was just sort of trying to figure out the narratives from looking at the pictures. And along with that, there were old detective novels and science fiction digests that always had weird, enigmatic, lurid covers and things, all these things that had such strong imagery that promised such interesting worlds and interesting stories. And then, you know, then later I would grow up and actually read these things and they never quite delivered. And I've always felt that in my work I was trying to kind of deliver on the promise of those images.
So did you use a lot of crayons when you were young, and did that like permanently affect your sense of what the colors in the world are?
Yeah, and I remember being very, very frustrated by crayons. They never had the colors I wanted, and it was never right. I really wanted these specific colors, and I learned at a very young age how to sort of crudely mix colors, and I would make my own shades of green, and they'd always wind up looking really muddy and brown and gray. And I look back at all my old coloring books, and they're really unbelievably hideous. They're really all kind of overworked and muddy and awful. So.
Now, you're working on a new movie called Art School Confidential.
Yes.
And which is based on a comic that you did, on a story in a comic that you did. You went to art school. Did you not hit it off in art school?
No, I have very mixed feelings about it. I went to art school in the late 70s in New York. And, you know, I went to art school wanting to draw the kind of comics that I draw now, though there really was no market in the world for such a thing. And none of my professors really understood what I was going for at all. These were all guys who had come of age in the 40s and 50s and who were still very in the world of abstract expressionism, or the ones who were slightly younger were in the throes of the 70s and conceptual art and all the many, many different little variants of the artistic styles that sort of, fractured out into a million permutations in that during that decade. And they had no idea why I would do something as literal as a narrative comic strip. And it was very frustrating. So I learned to meet other people who kind of understood what I was doing, other students. And from them, I learned the things I needed to learn and sort of learned what was working and what wasn't working and what was funny and wasn't funny. And from that, I learned a lot. So it's in retrospect, it was actually a very good experience. But I didn't really need to pay the tuition. I should have just, sort of hung around the dorm and met other kids.
Did drawing the human body and all the anatomy that you learn in art school help you with comics?
It did to some degree, although drawing the naked body is, I'm sure that's very useful for drawing superheroes who are essentially naked, but I like to draw, schlubby guys in ill-fitting clothes. And so I remember one time we didn't have a nude model, like they didn't show up, and the teacher tried to get a volunteer from class to pose sort of semi-nude, and nobody would do it. So we had to draw clothed models, and that was the best week I ever had in art school. I kept praying that would happen ever again, and it never quite did. So I had to sort of get in my drawing, on the side, and I did a lot of drawing on the subway. There were a lot of sort of early models for my characters on the New York subway in the late 70s.
But there is some nudity in your comics. And for instance, in your book, David Boring, the character says that in some ways he longs for the quote, old days when fetishes were applied to handkerchiefs and petticoats rather than directly to the frail physical form that can never live up to the embellished perfection of our ideals. And I'm wondering if that observation applies to you as an artist, if you ever kind of wish as an artist that there were still as many fetishes surrounding, like, petticoats and handkerchiefs and so on, because they'd give you more to draw. And I'm thinking, that there's a whole press actually that's dedicated now to, like, fetish graphics from the 50s.
Oh, many of them, yeah.
Yeah.
No, there's a great, I think that came from reading this great book called Psychopathia Sexualis by Kraft Ebbing, which was just a compendium of sexual neuroses, and some of them were incredibly mild for today. It's just sort of like mild homosexuality, and those were lumped in with some of the most gruesome and odd, forms of cannibalism and things like that. But mixed in there were all these really interesting sort of lost fetishes, and I found that so interesting. There were people, this is in sort of the pre, there was no form of sort of public nudity of any kind. So people would apparently go to museums and kind of get, like, rave over these nude statues, and I guess that was quite a common thing, that there were people who were obsessed with statuary, and I just think that's so quaint that there were so many exactly like things like petticoats and handkerchiefs, things that people don't have anymore. Of course those were fetish items, and it's such a charming thought to have a fetish about something that no longer even exists.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Clowes. He's a cartoonist and screenwriter. He does the series 8 Ball, David Boring, and he does Ghost World, and the movie Ghost World was based on his comics. In fact, he co-wrote the screenplay with Terry Zwigoff, and they've collaborated on a new movie called Art School Confidential that will open in the fall. This is the second screenplay that you've done. The first was, of course, Ghost
this
World.
This was my first solo screenplay. The other one was a collaboration.
Oh, I see. So what are some of the things that you learned from the experience of doing Ghost World that you were able to apply to writing Art School Confidential?
Well, I learned the main thing I learned was that editing is a good thing. I learned that was very helpful in my comics as well, and that editing was sort of a global thing, that it was good to get rid of absolutely everything that you didn't love. And in writing this script, I had so many things I could put in. I could talk about art school endlessly. I've said before that art school to me was like Vietnam to Oliver Stone. You know, it's just sort of an endless subject that I could go on and on about. And so I had to really limit myself and focus on the essential things, and I think that was such a good experience. So I feel like the finished film is really all stuff I'm very proud of. There's nothing in it that I feel is just filler or something that wasn't as good as I intended it to be. It's all very kind of worked out.
How has doing Ghost World changed your life?
I thought it would change my life a lot more. I thought once I had a movie out there, especially a movie that you know, it was not a huge hit, but it did very well, and it was nominated for an Oscar and all kinds of other awards. I thought that I would at least have something to talk to strangers about. I thought, you know, if I was sitting next to somebody on a plane, I would no longer have to go through the whole dull rigmarole of explaining the kind of comics that I do, which is truly a fruitless endeavor. So I thought I could say, oh, I wrote this movie Ghost World, and oh yes, I heard of that. And to this date, I have never met a single person who has ever heard of Ghost World in a public scenario. You know, if I've met somebody who's a friend of a friend, you know, they'll have heard of it. But I've never been sitting on a plane and talking to somebody who has heard of Ghost World. So it hasn't changed my life as much as I hoped.
Well, Daniel Clowes, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Terry.
Daniel Clowes' new comic strip novel is called Ice Haven.